Spedman, who is a professor of political science and senior fellow at Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation. I'm Jane Wales, president and CEO of the World Affairs Council. For those of you who don't know the Council, our mission is to engage the public in an exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. And if you want to learn more about us, we've got programs like this virtually every night, so do check us out online, www.itsyourworld.org. If you're unable to attend a program, you can hear, often we have programs on KQED every Monday night, the show KQED at It's Your World at 8 p.m. You can also visit our website for audio and video recordings of all of our evening programs, and check and see our or hear our past programs. Tonight's program is being taped by David Ogilvie. David, thank you. And so you can refer your friends to it. I'm going to take this opportunity while you're turning off your cell phones to tell you about two upcoming programs. On Tuesday, June the 2nd, we'll welcome Charles Delfer, who's the former deputy chairman of the UN Special Commission in Iraq, as well as the director of the CIA-led team charged with the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and I know what you're going to ask him. And then on Tuesday, June the 11th, we will host David Sanger. David is the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, and he'll provide an analysis of some of the most sensitive national security issues that face President Obama. Both of these programs will take place here at the Council at 6 p.m. Finally, let me just note that there are question cards at your seat, so Dr. Stedman is speaking, feel free to write down your questions, and they'll be brought up to me, and I will try to paraphrase them and group them and include as many as possible. It's my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker. Stephen Stedman is professor of political science and senior fellow at the Center for Security and International Cooperation at Stanford University. In addition, Dr. Stedman also serves as co-director of the Managing Global Insecurity Project, which is a joint endeavor of the Brookings Institution, the NYU, and Stanford University. He is a leading expert on civil wars and conflict management. Dr. Stedman served as an assistant secretary general at the United Nations, and while at the UN, he worked closely with Kofi Annan on what was called the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change. That was back in 2003, and after helping to draft an extraordinary report, he helped to gain worldwide support for the concepts and the recommendations of the panel. He co-authored his new book, which he's going to talk about tonight, with Bruce Jones and Carlos Pasquel. It is entitled Power and Responsibility, Building International Order in an Era of Transnational Threats. It's a truly important book, so please join me in welcoming Steve Stedman.
Thanks, Jane, and thank you all for coming this evening. I'm sometimes asked about the difference between life at the United Nations and life at Stanford, and actually there was one incident that really brought it all together. We were in the midst of negotiations in September of 2005. We were going to have a world summit, 175 heads of state were coming to New York, and we were negotiating the text on which all 175 heads of state were going to be expected to sign on to. And one of my responsibilities was issues of nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament, of which there is no mention whatsoever in the outcome document that was signed onto, and I was incredibly frustrated at the way that the negotiations were going, and one of the ambassadors saw me looking despondent, and he said, you know, what's with you? And I said, you know, my students at Stanford each year do a simulation, a crisis simulation of important international negotiations, And all I can say is, they take their job more seriously than you do. And he said, yeah, but I bet they're graded. Anyway, I'm going to talk tonight about our new book, Power and Responsibility. It very much came from my experience at the United Nations. I left in October of 2005, and I was very frustrated. I was frustrated, first of all, because while I was there, we discovered, you know, a dirty secret of American foreign policy, which is that every day the United States uses international institutions in order to protect the American people and make them more secure and more prosperous. Right? You would never know that listening to our politicians, who actually tend to make a career of trashing rhetorically international institutions. But my light bulb moment came from a meeting that my boss at the time, Kofi Annan, had in December of 2004 when he went to the White House. And the agenda for the meeting started with Afghanistan, where the United Nations had negotiated the bond agreement that had led to the installation of Hamid Karzai and the first democratic elections to be held in Afghanistan for 30-odd years, 40-odd years, and where the UN still had very good mediators trying to keep the peace process moving forward. The second thing on the agenda that day was Iraq, where despite the fact that the Security Council never authorized America's invasion of Iraq, which obviously won the wrath of the Bush administration, President Bush, within about 6 months, had turned to Kofi Annan and had asked the Secretary General to send one of his best mediators to Iraq to try to bring in Sunni insurgents into the political process, and also to try to bring Sistani on board and to convince him that elections should go forward. And of course, the elections were carried out by the United Nations. The third item on the agenda that day was Lebanon, where the UN was responsible for implementing the Security Council resolution of getting Syria out of Lebanon and of moving forward with the inquiry into the assassination of the former Prime Minister Hariri. The fourth item on the agenda that day was the Middle East peace process, or the lack thereof, because the UN is one of the quartet that is supposed to mediate and monitor developments in the region. The fifth item was the North-South peace agreement in Sudan, which had been partially mediated by the Bush administration. Senator Jack Danforth had played a huge role in getting the agreement for North-South peace, and the UN had put 12,000 peacekeepers in the region to try to implement the peace agreement. The sixth item was Darfur, where both President Bush and Kofi Annan wanted a more robust response. The seventh item on the agenda was Liberia, which has important ties to the United States, and where at the time the UN had 16,000 peacekeepers implementing a peace agreement and elections that would bring Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to power, the first woman elected head of state in Africa. And then the last item on the agenda that day was Haiti, where the UN had 6,500 peacekeepers. So you might be a hard-headed realist and say, who really cares about Haiti or Liberia or even Sudan? But you have to admit, a list that starts with Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and the Middle East would probably make it to the top of anyone's list of priorities. So there we were, and we knew that on a daily basis, the United States and Washington, D.C. makes demands of international institutions. And yet, having spent 2 years there, and my mandate during those 2 years was to try to strengthen the United Nations and to strengthen international commitment to the United Nations, was very, very much aware that our current international institutions need to be much more effective than they are, that they were built for a world of 60 years ago. They are not particularly well designed to tackle today's transnational challenges. The institution itself certainly isn't reflective of today's power relations. So these are all institutions and organizations that dramatically need to be transformed. So that was the sort of double frustration, because when you put them together, we could make a serious case to the Bush administration that it would benefit from stronger international institutions and a stronger United Nations, and we seemed to win acceptance of that argument, but they had no idea how to get stronger international institutions, and the biggest bit of evidence there was sending John Bolton as their ambassador to negotiate the reforms, suggestive that they just didn't quite understand how they were going to get more effective institutions. So at the same time, it turned out that one of the people that we negotiated with in 2005 was a man named Carlos Pascual. He was in the State Department at the time. He had been in the American government for almost 25 years, had served as an ambassador to the Ukraine at the time. He was the State Department's chief person on post-conflict peace building, and he was our interlocutor on trying to create a new peace building commission and a peace building support office. Well, he left the State Department around the same time, and he had his own set of frustrations about how American foreign policy simply was not designed to deal with the complexity of today and the challenges of today. So Bruce Jones, who was with me at the UN, Carlos Pascual, who had been in the State Department, the three of us got together and we said, let's look towards 2009 when there is a new administration, and let's write a book that tries to make a case for why international institutions and organizations like the United Nations are essential to American foreign policy, and try to give a new administration a strategy for strengthening them. The argument of the book goes like this, that we truly do live in an era of new threats, of new dangers that are very much unlike the world that of the 20th century. Climate change, transnational terrorism, regional instability, financial and economic instability, deadly infectious disease, a host of challenges that actually suggest that our security, American national security, is interdependent with security of people elsewhere. And that in a world of transnational threats and security interdependence, there's a premium on international cooperation. Our foreign policy has not adapted to that world. So let me say something about the United States. In a world of new transnational dangers, the U.S. cannot defend itself unilaterally against any of its major threats. So you take something like catastrophic terrorism, right? The prospect of terrorists getting their hands and creating an improvised nuclear device. What would a unilateral defense be against that? We argue there is none. The physicists tell us that the amount of highly enriched uranium that you would need to create an improvised nuclear weapon would fit into about 6-liter milk jugs. If you know how much contraband is smuggled into the United States on a daily basis, chances are probably not bad for a terrorist organization, if they were actually to get their hands on this much fissile material, that they could get it into the U.S. The knowledge is out there. Technology is out there. They would probably need, a safe haven within the United States for 8 or 10 months, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility that this could happen. So you say, well, how do you defend against that? Well, first of all, you would want international cooperation in cleaning up the excess stocks of fissile material that exist in the world, of which there's massive amounts. You would probably want to get ambitious and renegotiate the Non-Proliferation Treaty so that states no longer saw it as an inalienable right to develop their own capacity to create what is called the closed fuel cycle, or to create their own fissile materials. You obviously need the cooperation of others in terms of the movement of people, materials, and money that terrorists could use. You need their cooperation in strengthening their borders to better control the movement of these international people and goods. Now, so I've already given you like five levels of cooperation that is needed, five levels of cooperation that are needed. I haven't even gotten to a discussion of, you know, what are the factors that help produce terrorism, right? So layer upon layer upon layer of international cooperation, if you think the major threat is catastrophic terrorism. If you think the major threat that we face is climate change and global warming, then it's obvious. There is not going to be a solution unless there is international cooperation. That one's easy. Same with the financial crisis, by the way. That one's pretty easy. Deadly infectious disease, well, there are 800 million international air passengers every day. The incubation times of most newly emerging infectious disease is longer than the longest intercontinental air ride. So how are you going to defend against that? You can obviously build up very good public health in the United States. We should do that. But any defense against a newly infectious disease will have to come globally. There's going to have to be very good global pathogen surveillance and response. So just to make the point, in a world of new transnational dangers, the United States cannot defend itself unilaterally against these threats. Second, if the U.S. is to secure the cooperation of others in addressing what threatens us, we have to be prepared to cooperate with others in addressing what threatens them. This is pretty straightforward. This is something that my kids learned in preschool. You know, if you want the help of others, be prepared to help them. Why is it important? It's important because we live in a world that, you know, depending on your power, your privilege, and where you live, you see a world of different threats. Right? This is what I learned at the UN. One of the first things I had to do for the Secretary General is travel around the world and talk to people, ask them, you know, what are your major threats? You know, we talk to governments, we talk to people, we talk to NGOs, we talk to university students. And not surprising, when you have that discussion in Africa, nobody says, oh, nuclear terrorism, that's our biggest threat, right? No, that's not their biggest threat. Their biggest threat is HIV/AIDS, grinding poverty, malaria, tuberculosis, bad governance, right? That's what they wanted to talk about. That's what threatens them. And if you take something like HIV/AIDS, which takes, you know, in some cases has taken 40 years off the life expectancy of individuals in some African countries, that's a, you know, a dire threat. So the point is, that's the kind of world we live in. We live in an interconnected world, an interdependent world, but we live in a world where threats are perceived differently, and we have to be prepared to cooperate with others in addressing their threats if we want their cooperation in addressing our threats. Third, in an interdependent world where you need cooperation, military power alone is overrated, and it can actually be counterproductive in getting the kind of cooperation that you need. This country spends about $750 billion a year on defense. We spend more on defense than the rest of the world combined. Think about that. There are 192 member states of the United Nations. The U.S. spends more on defense than the rest of the world combined. China, depending on your estimates, the estimates of their spending run from, you know, $45 billion to $120 billion. All of the EU spend about $200 billion on defense. Russia spends about $40 billion on defense. The rest of the world, it's kind of peanuts. What is it by us? If you just think back on the last 8 years, what has this incredible military might actually bought us in terms of safety, security? What has it done in terms of getting us cooperation, right? Couldn't get us a Security Council resolution on Iraq, right? couldn't get us a robust coalition in Afghanistan. So you have to ask yourself, what is it? What is this stuff for? What does it buy you exactly? Moreover, when you turn a threat into a global war, like we did with terrorism, this is counterproductive. There are a lot of countries that stopped cooperating with us because of how we pursued the threat of terrorism. Fourth, I've already mentioned to you that international institutions are much more important to the United States than policymakers admit. And I've also said that these institutions need to be strengthened. Many countries, however, even some close allies, resist strengthening these institutions, including working against reform of the United Nations in 2005, because they were asking themselves a question. If the United States wants stronger international institutions, and this is to help them pursue unilateral goals, why exactly are we going to strengthen these institutions? Right? Some of them had a choice. You know, we can have more effective institutions or we can have a global encounter session. We'll take the global encounter session as long as this doesn't allow the United States to further its unilateral agenda and its unilateral way of conducting its foreign relations. Right? So it leads me to my last point. If the U.S. is to obtain cooperation in strengthening international institutions, indeed in addressing the various transnational threats that we look at the book, in the book, climate change, terrorism, civil wars and regional insecurity, economic instability, biological security, we have to stop treating these institutions as mere tools of American foreign policy, right? We pick them up when they're useful, we put them down when they're not. And when we put them down, we always say, oh, they're not important, right? I gave a talk about a year and a half ago to a bipartisan group, and I started with the list that I started with tonight. Here was the agenda. Here's what the UN gets you. There's a Republican who served in the Bush administration. He raised his hand. He says, Steve, that was terrific. And that's how you have to sell the UN to the American public. The UN is a great tool of American foreign policy. A Democrat across the aisle raises his hands. Steve, he's right. That's how you're going to sell this to the American people. I don't think he used tool. I think he said, they're a great instrument of American foreign policy. That was fine, except there were people from Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America in the room. Their arms all shot up. And they said, no, thank you. Right? If all you're talking about is creating a better tool of American foreign policy, count us out. Right? What's in it for us? Right? Where is the sense that your strengthening of these institutions is creating an order in which all of our goals are advanced, where all of us feel more secure, all of us can be more prosperous? And by the way, what's going to underpin this so that we're assured that the institution that you use today, when it goes in your favor, you're not going to trash tomorrow when it says, actually, we disagree. Where's the commitment? So we set out in this book to say, actually, we've got to tackle this head on. We have to be willing to try to rebuild international order based on principles. The principle that we put forward we've called responsible sovereignty, the sense that sovereignty entails not just the prerogatives for states, but obligations of states, obligations to their own citizens, obligations to each other, and obligations to the world's citizens, right? That you have to have some kind of organizing principle and a sense that what we're trying to build here is international order, not just institutions as convenient as instruments when they are convenient, right? That's the struggle. Our argument is that this is possible, that to get there, You're going to need American leadership, but it's going to have to be a new kind of leadership. It's going to have to be a kind of leadership that's willing to listen. It's willing to acknowledge that American security is interdependent with everyone else's, that American prosperity is interdependent with everyone else's. If we're not willing to acknowledge that, you're not going to get very far in this world. Second, you're going to need institutionalized cooperation between the United States, its traditional allies in Europe and in Japan, and the newly emerging countries, powers like China, like India, like Brazil, like South Africa, like Mexico. Third, you're going to have to go issue by issue, and the emerging powers, the traditional powers in the United States, are going to have to negotiate what responsible sovereignty means in the field of climate change, for instance, in dealing with civil wars, in dealing with counterterrorism, in dealing with deadly infectious disease. This is not as hard as it sounds, because in fact there is already a basis in international law on which you can build, where states have already agreed on important norms and standards. Finally, you're going to have to be willing to invest in international institutions, because they're the ones that are going to implement a lot of the policy decisions that states take. That is the way the world works. If you are interested in a long time horizon and you want cooperation to be more than sporadic or temporary, it's institutions that provide the long-term horizon. That's how they work. Why don't I stop here, I'm willing to take your questions, and I'm curious to hear your reactions. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't we start with the conceptual framework and start with a sort of predecessor to responsible sovereignty, and that is the concept of the responsibility to protect. The notion that a state is obliged to protect its citizens from mass atrocities, and if it fails to do so, the international community has both the right and the responsibility to step in. Has that concept taken hold? And because that's a norm that was advanced in 2002, 2003, 2004. Has that fully taken hold and been rendered operational?
It hasn't taken hold, and it hasn't been rendered operational. But it's not the predecessor to responsible sovereignty. Our ideas of responsible sovereignty actually come from an African statesman and scholar named Francis Steng, who was writing in the early 1990s. And he was from Sudan, and he was absolutely appalled at what was going on in his country. This was back in the late 80s, early 90s, where the government routinely would deny access to international assistance to populations at risk. Hundreds of thousands of people dying, and the government would routinely refuse to allow assistance to them. And he started talking about the fact that traditional notions of sovereignty as, you know, non-interference, these are internal matters, we can do as we damn well please, simply wasn't working for Africa. And that Africa had to create new norms of sovereignty, new norms that would emphasize the fact that the first obligation of a state has to be to promoting the dignity of its citizens, that states had to have obligations to each other, and that states also, the most powerful states, had to have an obligation to step in when some states simply would not meet, were unable, or would not meet the demands of their own population in terms of dignity and livelihoods. This was actually the predecessor to responsibility to protect. Normatively, what Francis Steng did was revolutionary, because, just as an example, somebody had written a book just a year before Francis started writing this stuff, saying, well, if you look all at Africa, you see a bunch of states that are states in name only. They hide behind this protection that sovereignty gives them, but they're not really states. They're quasi-states. They're legal states, but they're not empirical states. They don't really provide for their citizens. They provide for the good of the rulers. And this book said, and you know what? Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it and actually get to the heart of this problem. Well, here was an African saying, no, we acknowledge this, and we are going to get to the heart of it. And we trace, you know, this is, you know, in historical time, we're talking 18 years from when Francis started writing this to now. And our ideas have changed dramatically. Kofi Annan gave a speech as Secretary General in 1998 to the General Assembly, and this was right after Kosovo, and said, we have a real problem here. We had a problem with Rwanda when there was no response. You got all angry when there was a response to Kosovo, but we have to have a talk here about when is it, under what conditions is it legal to have humanitarian intervention to actually protect people. And he was roundly criticized by the non-aligned movement, right? And again, falling back on the old mantra, non-interference, we can do what we please, right? 3 years after that, Gareth Evans, Mohamed Sanoun do this panel, and they create this idea of the responsibility to protect, right? If states are unable or unwilling to protect their own people, then others have the responsibility to step in and do it for them, right? 2001. 2005, that's actually agreed upon in General Assembly language. So from 98 to 2005, again, at least normatively, things had shifted. People all of a sudden understood there was a problem. My office had to negotiate this in 2005 at the UN. The argument that trumped the day every time was, let's talk about specifics. Were you outraged that there was no response to Rwanda in 1994? Yes, we were outraged. It was outrageous that the Security Council withdrew in the face of genocide. Yes, absolutely outrageous. If it happened tomorrow, you would want a different response. Yes, we would want a different response. All right, how are we going to get it? Right? It's a very practical discussion. That got countries of very different political persuasions to sign on, because by 2005, Africans themselves were in the leadership positions demanding this change, demanding the change in terms of how we think about this. It doesn't mean that this was popular with everyone. It doesn't mean that everyone was really accepting of this norm. It just stated, you know, as a norm, this is what we believe in. And now the ground has shifted. It's shifted to the capabilities question. How do you create the capabilities so that if the UN is supposed to be responsible, there is an ability to respond, right? Not just responsibility, but responsibility. And that's a key change. You know, you won the normative argument. Now it's how do you actually get the commitments and resources and the capabilities to do it.
And there, I mean, in your book, you speak to two changes in the institutional arrangements. One, the creation of a G16, which are the existing great powers plus rising powers, and I'd love to have you speak to that. But you've also wrote of the importance of strong regional arrangements, regional institutions like the African Union, but perhaps rendered more effective than it currently is. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what it would take to get from here to there in both cases. I would think the harder case being the regional arrangements.
Yeah, the easier one is actually, you know, our book argues that the first place that you start is you get rid of the G8. The G8 has run its course, it's passed its due date. It was designed for a world of 30 years ago. It no longer can address any major problem in the world. Problems are global. So even, you know, the G8 was established primarily to deal with economic cooperation and questions of financial stability, it can't even do that anymore. And the evidence of that was in the midst of the financial meltdown, President Bush, to his credit, actually invited the heads of state of the G20, of the 20 leading economies, to Washington, D.C. in November. And then Gordon Brown said, now we are going to follow this up and we are going to meet in London in April. Our argument in the book was that this is precisely the vehicle that you need. If you're going to pre-negotiate a whole host of difficult international issues where you need the cooperation of major and emerging powers, it would require countries that aren't used to meeting with each other to meet at heads of state level once a year. It would then require their foreign ministers to meet more often. It would have trickle-down effects in the bureaucracy. Our foreign policy is still designed towards Europe and towards Japan. That's fine. Those have been our traditional allies. But we live in a different world. And what we're suggesting is it should be as normal for the director of policy planning at the State Department, for instance, to, on an annual basis, meet her counterpart in Beijing or in Delhi or in Brazil or in Mexico, as it is for her to meet her counterparts in London, Paris, and Rome, right, for a global world. Now, we were hoping that the Italians, who have the G8 meeting in July, would simply put the G8 out of its misery and just say, it's time to move on. Let's get rid of it, and we're going to create something else, because we now have a G20. Maybe we should just have a G20. For us, the G number doesn't matter, right? It could be 13, which is the G8 plus what was called the Outreach 5. For the last 3 years, the G8 has invited China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and Mexico to its meetings, and has done it in such a ham-handed way that the G5 come away, the Outreach 5 come away saying, but we're not little children to be kept waiting, you know, to be brought in for lunch. You know, we should be part of the club. So you could do a G13. You could do the G20. The problem with the G20 is that if you actually look at who showed up in London, it was actually 24. Nice sleight of hand there. And at that point, it's beginning to become unwieldy, and it's not clear that you have the right, even if it was 20, that you have the right 20, right? But the key here is transform, get rid of the G8 and come up with something else where you can pre-negotiate a host of tough issues amongst those states that actually have the power to move other countries and to move solutions, right? So that one is easier, right? Although the Italians didn't do it. The Italians said, this is great. I mean, I don't know where it stands now because I'm no longer in these discussions, but for a while, and maybe this is how it will be, on the first day, the G8 will meet as the G8. The Outreach 5 will meet as the G5 separately. On Saturday, we'll bring them all together in the morning. And then in the afternoon, we'll invite a bunch of African heads of state to meet with the newly reconstituted G13. And then on Sunday, we're going to have the G20 that met in London come on Sunday, and you can see where this is going to be a disaster, right? So you should just kill the thing and move on. The regions. When you start looking around, it is fascinating because different regions are simply developing at much different speeds in terms of coming together to define what norms are appropriate for their region, what they want governance to be, what they want sovereignty to be, and what they are doing in terms of capabilities. In terms of norms, we argue that actually the African Union is far out in front, right? If you look at the African Union Charter for Peace and Security, it talks about things like responsible sovereignty. It talks about the fact that what should happen when a country simply, doesn't provide for the dignity of its citizens, right? All those discussions, they don't have the capabilities, though, right? So that one's, you know, how do you get the capabilities to get up to speed with the norms? In some areas, you have nothing. I mean, where you have the toughest security problems, where you desperately need cooperation, you have no institutions. Middle East,
South Asia, Northeast Asia. I mean, some of the hope was that the six-party talks, for instance, on North Korea could eventually become some kind of a regional institution itself that would deal with security matters.
You should name the six parties.
Yeah, the six parties, China, Russia, the United States, North Korea, South Korea, and Japan, right? They're there to negotiate, like, what do you do with North Korea, right? But if they were successful in dealing with North Korea, the idea was you would want to actually create this as an ongoing regional forum for dealing with security problems of that area, right? So this is a big challenge, and it's the toughest challenge on the regions. Where you don't have institutions, how are you going to build them?
One of our questioners suggested I'm going to have to find the card, an Asian American consortium as is in essence a NATO for Asia. Tell us something about the role of ASEAN and why it can or cannot evolve into that.
Mostly because I can't imagine that there's any government in Asia that would want to be in that kind of structure. You know, NATO is special. It's sui generis. If you actually go back to the 1950s and 60s, some of you will remember there was a CETO and there was a CENTO, right? It wasn't just NATO, it was CENTO and CETO. They no longer exist, we can't even remember them, and there was good reasons. The United States simply could not play the security role with the buy-in of countries in Central Asia, in the Middle East, and in South Asia that we did in Europe. These governments are not looking for a United States dominant organization, right? They are, in the case of ASEAN, very slowly redefining what they expect of each other as responsible states in the region. They're doing it at their own pace. They are nowhere near where the African Union is, for instance, on norms. Yet in terms of capabilities, they can be impressive. So I just don't see it happening because I don't see any demand for it.
What do you see as, for example, were all the recommendations in your book implemented, and we had this very different architecture in place, what would be the approach to North Korea? What would be the solution? What would be the approach to Myanmar, to Burma, as opposed to the current approach?
The biggest difference on something like Myanmar would be the ability of the United States, India, which gets a complete free ride on discussions of Myanmar, and China, in a setting of the G16, of the most powerful states, to sit down and discuss what are their shared interests and why instability in Myanmar is not in the interests of India and China, who are the two countries that actually have some leverage on Myanmar. We have no leverage on Myanmar. The Europeans have no leverage on Myanmar. We kid ourselves in thinking that we can somehow impose a solution on Myanmar. But China has leverage. India has leverage. And so the difference is that you are going to try to find some kind of accommodation in which all of these powers are actually pulling in the same direction for some end goal in terms of Myanmar. It takes convincing them, in India and a China, that this bizarre regime that is a throwback to, you know, the 1800s, that wants to close itself off from the world is going to be unstable in ways that are going to be detrimental to their interests, if not now, then in the medium to long term. And if you can't have that conversation and you can't find common ground, you have no prayer of solving Myanmar.
Take us to a different part of the world, not so far away, and that's Iran. How could you get from where we currently are to the world in which you describe?
Iran is
in terms of decision making and problem solving.
Mm-hmm. I actually think that what the Obama administration has started to do is exactly the steps that are needed. What the Europeans were telling us, for a long time was that if you're going to address Iran, it is very clear that there is going to need to be a bilateral approach by the United States to Iran, but in an overall context of an international coalition that's actually trying to create some boundaries as to what is acceptable behavior by Iran or not. Everybody, it's easy to think that bilateralism is an antithetical to multilateralism or strong support for international institutions. It's not true. Oftentimes, what you can do bilaterally can actually strengthen your multilateral approaches and can strengthen your international institutions. So I actually think on Iran, they've started the ball in the right direction. The other thing that has to happen with Iran is strengthening our relations with Russia and China, because Russia and China have a big voice in what Iran will or won't be able to do. We have to be able to have a conversation with China that says, you have to understand, China, that you've become a big player in energy, you've become a big player in the Middle East. This is a part of the world that you do not want unstable, right? You now have a stake. You have gained in power. You now have to take on greater responsibility, and part of that responsibility is going to be stability in the Middle East. Now ask yourself, do you think you're going to get stability in the Middle East if Iran gets a weapon and then you see a cascade of proliferation in this region? And if the answer is no, then we have to start talking. We have to start talking that your short-term business and energy interests should not trump your medium to long-term interests in making sure that this is a stable region. So those are the kinds of discussions that you can have, because it's hard to see a solution to Iran if you can't convince the Russians and the Chinese to cooperate.
And this would be in the context of the G16 that these conversations can occur.
I think that's the best way to do it, yeah. Even within the G16, as within any international institution, I mean, one of the things that we learned is to get consensus in any kind of international organization, you don't start with everyone. You build consensus by concentric circles. So some have written that, well, you don't need a G16, you need a G2. You need the United States and China, perhaps. Maybe that's how you're going to build your consensus in the G16. When the EU acts, it's because the big three, France, UK, and Germany, have come to agreement on something. Once they've come to agreement on something, by concentric circles, they can build out so that the EU agrees on something. And this is something that I think would probably work within a G16 context. Again, the importance of some of ideas like the G2, the United States and China, is to make it a complementarity to making larger institutions work and not as a substitute.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to go back to the larger institutions, to the UN, but let me just, while we're on Iran, Iran recently held a summit with India and Afghanistan, with Karzai and Zardari and Ahmadinejad all together. Should we be fearful of this? Should we see this as positive in some ways? Should we see it as both negative and positive?
I take it as positive. Because there is a commonality of interest here on Afghan stability. I once heard Carl Eikenberry talk at Stanford. This was back in, 2004 or so, 2005, and where he said basically Iran had been very cooperative, for several years in terms of how to deal with Afghanistan. But after the Iraq War, that cooperation started to decline pretty dramatically. If you're going to deal with Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's hard for me to imagine how you're going to come into any kind of solution if you don't have you know, the stakeholders, the most important stakeholders at the table. If you don't have Iran, India, China, and the United States being willing to sit down and talk about what their equities are in Afghanistan and Pakistan and find a way to move forward, I don't see it happening. It's not to say that there necessarily is a common set of interests. I think they're there to be discovered. But it's hard for me to imagine how you're going to get stability in Pakistan if if India seeks to undermine it, if China sees things in a different light, if Iran wants to play a nasty role. Oh, and by the way, if Saudi Arabia wants to play a nasty role. So getting these countries on board to try to at least pull in the same direction doesn't guarantee solutions, but it seems to me it's probably going to be a prerequisite to any solutions.
Yeah, Iran and Pakistan have been regional rivals in the past. What role does the possession of nuclear weapons, the potential possession of nuclear weapons, play in the regional dynamics now?
It's a great question. I mean, it's a conversation that you can't have on the Iranian side, because all they will say is we're not building a nuclear weapon. We're, you know, building peaceful nuclear energy. But it's we have security discussions with, you know, most of the emerging powers, and we have some security discussions obviously with our closest allies about, you know, what are your threats? How do you, you know, how should we deal with them? And it's something that we don't have that with Iran. We can't even imagine, what is their nuclear weapon about, if they truly are trying to develop a nuclear weapon. What is it about? Is it about Pakistan? I don't think it's about Pakistan, but is it about Pakistan?
Well, the question is it about security or is it about prestige?
Both, yeah.
The question, we have several question cards that ask about the composition of the Security Council in this new world in which you have the G16, you're seeking strengthened regional institutions. What would the composition of the Security Council look like?
We believe that the Security Council needs to be changed to reflect today's structure and distribution of power, which means that you obviously want countries like India to play a larger role, Brazil should play a larger role, Japan should play a larger role. The Security Council reflects the world of 1945. It does not reflect the world of today. Having said that, and having negotiated this issue in 2005, this is not the place you want to start. If you want to build international cooperation, don't try starting with the Security Council, because it just sucks the energy and common sense out of everybody in the room. So what we argue is, let's start with the G16, and if you have these powers showing, you know, over several years that they're able to work with each other, they actually can create some sense of shared interest, some commonalities of approach, and some confidence and trust in one another. Then you can go back to the larger institution like the United Nations and really try to transform it. But if you try to start with the Security Council, I'll tell you, in 2005 when we negotiated this, this just closed down everything. Because, you know, for every Germany, there's an Italy. For Brazil, there's Mexico, Argentina, Chile. For Japan, there's South Korea and Indonesia. Right, we used to call them the group of losers, but you know they saw it as zero sum. You know, if India was going to get a permanent seat on the Security Council, Pakistan sure was not. You can come up with some solutions to get there, but again, you know, from our perspective, it's not the place. You would never want to start there. You would want to first build some confidence and trust and show that there is some grounds for cooperation before trying to tackle that.
Well, let me step back for a second, because in the book, it seems to me you do talk a little bit about having the greatest contributors to peace and security from each region play a role on the Security Council. And one of the question cards speaks to the question of of good actors versus bad actors, and and asks about how do you avoid a situation such as the Libyan leadership of the UN Human Rights Commission, or you know, a situation in which an institution is discredited by virtue of which players are playing a role.
In some respects, that is the danger of the universal institutions, where every member state is treated equally. That's not the case with the Security Council, which is the most important organ within the United Nations. So we don't see it as a particular danger in terms of the Security Council. My feeling on both, you know, the Human Rights Council, for instance, which replaced the old Human Rights Commission, is that a lot of nonsense happens because the more powerful states really don't make it a priority to try to stop the nonsense. I mean, if it really mattered to the United States, right, that the Human Rights Council was going to say something stupid about Israel, you can't convince me that, you know, if it really mattered to us, you know, we couldn't put, you know, the package of economic carrots, you know, disincentives, you know, all kinds of things together to get enough votes to make sure it didn't say something stupid. So that's why I'm actually a believer that, you know, even in these more universal bodies, the United States should be a part, should be active, and it should make it a priority to try to make them work. Because we know that if they're not there, then they really do run wild and do a lot of silly things.
One of the questioners asks about whether international organizations aren't obsolete at this point, and we shouldn't be thinking about networks instead. Can you say a word about that, particularly given that Anne Marie Slaughter is now Director of Policy Plans at State Department? She's written a lot about the role of networks in transnational governance and in solving problems. Say a word about the role of networks.
Yeah. Well, Anne Marie blurbed our book, so maybe we've convinced her. What we say to her is networks are important, but networks are important because the people, the nodes in the networks are in institutions. It's not just networks out there free-floating. You know, the network to deal with nonproliferation consists of individuals in government institutions, individuals within the IAEA, you know, people who have institutions behind them so that it actually means something that they're coordinating their approaches. These aren't free-floating individuals. It's hard for me to imagine how you're going to deal with, you know, a new deadly influenza pandemic if you don't have the World Health Organization and especially its Global Outbreak Alert Response Network. Right, I don't see it happening. I don't see how you're going to deal with non-proliferation if you don't have a strong and effective IAEA. You know, on a daily basis, they're in, you know, 180 countries, 180 odd countries, you know, finding out what's happening, monitoring what's happening, trying to get countries to live up to their commitments under the non-proliferation treaty. What is the substitute for that? Networks can only function if the individuals are embedded within institutions, so it means something. You know, if Anne Marie goes out and meets somebody right now anywhere in the world to try to solve a problem, it matters a lot more that she's director of policy planning in the institution of the State Department than it did as an academic or as dean of the Woodrow Wilson School. Not that there's anything wrong with the Woodrow Wilson School, but it's just true, right? There is power behind, power and authority that is behind the institution that she sits in, and that's what's important.
In fairness to Anne Marie Slaughter, her argument actually is that you have networks of people who are embedded in institutions. So
right, it's not an alternative.
Yeah. Let me sort of turn to the role of the private sector as well. Talk about the role that the private sector can play, the role of science and the role of industry can play in a strengthened biological weapons convention, for example, both in developing such a convention and in monitoring compliance.
We don't talk about the biological weapons convention per se. We actually draw back and say, we have a problem right now that's on the horizon. It's now and it's on the horizon, which is the safety and security of biotechnology. And that advances in biotechnology are occurring so rapidly that we now live in a world where tens of thousands of graduate students, no matter where they are in the world, laboratories all around the world, can do experimentation and manipulations that were thought of as science fiction just 3 years ago, right? There is an enormous amount of good that can come from this, from these advances, but we all know the history of almost every major technological development. There's also enormous potential for the dark side or harm, purposeful harm or accidental harm. Yet getting any kind of international regime to address this problem is incredibly difficult because it can't look and it won't be like anything that we think of as an international regime. It won't be like the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It can't be governments. The problem is too diffuse, right? Tens of thousands of people with knowledge in laboratories all around the world, right, doing cutting-edge manipulations in biotechnology. How do you deal with that to make sure it's safe? You need governments, obviously, but you need science, you need industry, right? You're going to need non-governmental organizations. You're going to have to create something that is very different from anything that we have today. It's going to have to be something, it's assisted by top-down initiatives that governments may take on. But governments, if they're too heavy-handed with regulation, can kill the bright side of the technological revolution in biotechnology, right? So it can't be too heavy-handed. On the other hand, none of us believe that this is going to be a self-regulating industry. Anybody who has any beliefs in self-regulation these days ought to just look at what happened in the financial industries over the last decade, right? Self-regulation of dangerous products doesn't work. So there's going to have to be something that's very different from what we have now. The difficulty is there isn't yet a scientific consensus there, and there isn't yet an industry consensus there. So there's a lot of missionary work that has to be done to convince people this is a real problem, and we ought to deal with it now before you have the first intentional manipulation, you know, that is going to lead to massive amounts of harm, or an accidental release that leads to harm.
Well, and surely from industry's point of view, it is far more likely that there would be regulations that they would find harmful to the industry if this were after a use of a dangerous pathogen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the argument that can be made, especially to heads of corporations who, you know, have the responsibility to understanding a longer time horizon, right? That, you know, understand what's going to happen to your industry if something bad really happens, the industry as a whole, and your particular product. But also, right on this regulation, do you think you're going to get smart regulation, light regulation, effective regulation after an incident, a deadly incident? There is a case that can be made there, but it's what we found was.
And isn't there a bit of a precedent also with a chemical, with the chemical manufacturers when it came to the Chemical Weapons Convention?
There is. It's a backstory that I don't know very well, but what I've heard from people in the Clinton administration was that one of the differences in terms of getting the chemical weapons treaty ratification and protocol was that you did get industry buy-in, which you never got in terms of the biological weapons convention.
Moving from the private sector, let me just ask you a bit about the nonprofit sector and the role that, NGOs, that non-governmental organizations, can and would play in a follow-on to the Kyoto Accords. A climate change agreement.
One of the areas has to do with, you know, how do you monitor, how do you set and monitor standards in terms of carbon emissions? A lot of this can come and be driven by NGOs who, you know, are going to have to be the sticklers for industry performance in terms of meeting various standards, in terms of government performance. Again, a massive problem that you simply cannot leave to governments alone. I have to say, I mean, you know, the intellectual tradition in which I sort of was raised in graduate school was realism, was international relations realism, which should not be confused with having a realistic understanding of the world, right? It's a different thing. It's a theory, and but it's called realism. And in realism, the realism of the 20th century is that states are the only actors. Nothing else matters. What we say is states are still the primary actors, but it's very clear that in the case of climate change and in biotechnology, unless you're incredibly creative of how you match what states can do with the energies and capabilities and powers of the NGO sector and private sector, you're just not going to get very far. So this is sort of a major adaptation to this worldview that it's only states that matter.
Yeah. I'm going to end with a question by asking you how you think that the Obama administration is doing thus far. We have a question card asking about Ambassador Susan Rice, but before getting to that question, note that some of the question cards speak to an inability on the part of some policymakers to see sovereignty the way you see sovereignty, a tendency to worry about. I mean, this questioner wrote that a Congress member of Congress said to her that when we ratify an international agreement, that then international law supersedes our law, and that can't be allowed to happen. So that's an anxiety that is still there. Is the Obama administration demonstrating the kind of leadership that can bring us past that mindset to the mindset that is necessary in order to implement the kinds of recommendations you've put forth in your book?
Yes. It has some of the things that President Obama has done, I just think have been incredibly impressive in a very short period of time. The way that he has conducted himself internationally to try to rebuild confidence, global confidence in the United States, has been impressive. What he's done already on Iran, I think, is impressive. What he had to say about nuclear weapons was mind-boggling. Right? And I never thought I would see an American president, get up there and say, I really do want a world of no nuclear weapons. We may not see it in my lifetime, but here are the steps that we're going to take to try to move this process. On a whole host of issues, he, to my mind, is doing the right thing, and he's building the groundwork for a web of international cooperation on a host of problems. What he hasn't done yet that I would like to see is really an enunciation of what is our grand strategy now. Because until you announce and describe what your grand strategy is, it's very easy for parts of the government not to get with the program, right? Yes we can meets no we can't. And it's not to say that enunciating a grand strategy means everybody gets behind it, but it really does provide a clarity of, what is it that we're striving for? What are our priorities? What are the capabilities that we need? I mean, if you take our book seriously, you know, you have to start asking ourselves some questions about how we conduct foreign policy. Are we organized for complexity? No. Are we organized to cooperate with others? No. Not really. So that's what I would love to see is for him to lay out the speech. You know, what is America's grand strategy in an interdependent world where our security depends on the actions and cooperation of others?
Would you please join me in thanking Dr. Subrat Sadman?